Welcome to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that's got the commentary, news, opinion, questions and answers, all the things that you want to know. It's brought to you by nobody except me. We have no sponsors, we don't take free stuff, we don't endorse things simply because they've basically sent us things in the mail. Nothing like that. This is totally honest from the gut. It's also unscripted. I mean, I don't have a script here that I follow. I do have a few bullet points that I look at, but other than that, this is not a scripted show that's meant to impress you with its production value. And so let's get right on at it. We have AOC, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, a congresswoman who went down to the border. And why is that important? Why is that even important to gun owners? Well, it's because she goes down there and shows absolutely no interest in the American citizens who live in vicinity of the border, whose homes are getting overrun, whose personal safety is in danger, because anybody, including the Mexican military, has come across the border and essentially can do whatever they want. They can run all over your area. They can run all over your personal property. They can steal from you. All this stuff can happen, and nobody protects you, except there's a thin line of Border Patrol people, who agents who round these folks up and try to get them on their, they try to sort out their situations and all this. So this is important because you don't have any defense down there other than your own personal weapon, and you could run into some very, very bad people. I mean, it's no coincidence that the porous southern border has led to the fact that MS-13 is all over the place, and that drug cartels are operating in American cities, and there's all these closet communities of undocumented illegals who are here working. So this is a big issue. Now, of course, Cortez shows no absolutely no sympathy towards the American citizens that are there, regardless of their ethnicity or background. She only really cares about these migrants, she calls them, and down there telling what are specious and untrue stories about the facilities they're in. It's just terrible. I mean, she has no real perception of reality. I mean, even, you hate to say this, but you just look at her. She always has this kind of wild-eyed stare, look like she's just seen a UFO or something. I mean, she just doesn't look like a very rational or a very logical person to me. Completely driven by some sort of emotions. And of course, in the criticisms of the facilities, and the criticism that the, Border Patrol, ICE, all that has been getting, apparently there's a closed Facebook group. Take this as a warning. Facebook is not a good place, but there was a closed group where people were basically criticizing her, probably saying unkind things, probably putting up, memes and all the rest of this to make her look stupid. Now, it's among themselves, so I don't see this as a real big deal, but it'll get seized upon, but just be careful. Facebook evidently has no problem turning over your closed group stuff to anybody who wants it, especially if it fits their political agenda. The next one is a pretty interesting situation. I don't really like talking about it because actually it affects my home personally, but Kamala Harris, she was some sort of hardcore prosecutor. Now she's turned into some bleeding heart liberal. She was going after Biden about his remarks of he used to have to work with what he considered to be segregationist senators to get legislation done. All that, whatever that conversation is, it is. And also his stance on anti-busing. And she basically is put up that she was, somehow assisted by busing. But let me tell you the real deal. School busing was an absolute disaster. School busing put a lot of the social pressures, ills, and corrections, and things that should have been handled in other venues, it put it square on the backs of children. Children just trying to go to school. And they would force kids that you might have to take a 45-minute bus ride each way, maybe even longer. When you're passing two or three schools that are closer by that, you know, by all rights you should have been going to. They did this out of the perceived need to achieve some sort of desegregation. And while some of these goals were lofty goals and worthy goals, it didn't work. Based on geography, school after busing was over, and it died out about the year 2000. Schools essentially resegregated just based on geography and economics and a few other things. So the answer is not to bring other kids into a school and try to make it. The answer is to try to make better schools so that you can get somewhere from it. That's the answer. My wife was a victim of school busing. Was put into a brand new high school was built, you know, and they had this insanely long bus ride. And students from a variety of backgrounds, whether it was the suburbs, which were predominantly white, or the inner city, which was black, were all put into this school. And of course, the usual antics and chicanery followed forth. And people like Kamala Harris, you know, she and her thug friends could essentially carve out turf and act like it's the inner city. The other kids that were bused there, you know, they can only use certain bathrooms because the others are controlled by some faction. This was all bull. It was complete bull. And the people responsible for it should have been punished. The politicians and judges who forced that on American children should have been punished. And it just goes to show you, if you think there would be any rational thinking in a Kamala Harris administration, you are you're sadly mistaken. Okay, in the gun media, let's see. Oh, we have InRange TV did a question and answer. One of the big questions was something that I addressed in an earlier podcast to great extent. And that was the FNFAL in the rifle trials of the late 1950s. A lot of people say it's versus the M14. It really wasn't. But there were a couple different rifles in those trials. It was the FNFAL, a post-war design, essentially, from Belgium. There was the Armalite AR-10, which came from the Armalite division of Fairchild Aircraft, which everyone kind of knows that if you're a gun enthusiast, the ancestor of the AR-15, which became the M16. And then there was the Springfield Armory M14, which was a product improved, M1 Garand. And of course, they managed to mangle it pretty hard, but I'll go over it again very quickly. In the 1950s, World War III was considered winnable. It wasn't the mutually assured destruction of missiles that you see portrayed in movies like Dr. Strangelove and all these things from the 60s. In the 50s, it was a different deal. We might have had to mobilize our national manpower base of all our military-aged males. Most of those people had been in the Second World War or Korea. They were very familiar with the Garand system and the similar M1 carbine. They were very familiar with those. So it only made sense from the United States perspective to adopt a similar rifle. It made sense also because the Army was very pleased with the performance of the M1 rifle in World War II and Korea. Its only real debit was the cartridge was long, heavy, and it was not magazine fed. The M14 corrected that. The M14 was box magazine fed, 20 rounds. It fired a shorter, improved cartridge, which, thanks to newer types of powder, could generate a very similar velocity to the older 30-06 or 30 caliber M1 round or M2 round. So we basically had a product improved version of something that we knew worked in two wars. I mean, we just knew it. So it was almost a foregone conclusion that that rifle would become adopted. It was also a pound lighter. It had similar sights. It had a similar trigger. It essentially could be taken apart, disassembled in a similar way, not exactly the same way, but very similar. So the training to get somebody who knew an M1 rifle up to speed on an M14 was very, very fast. And if you're talking about mobilizing a million or even several million people, that's going to be a big deal. So, you know, it was a great rifle. It also, you know, it had a very simple gas system. And we were going to shoot quality ammunition in it. We didn't need the adjustable gas system the FNFAL had, simply because we were going to have stockpiles of quality NATO spec ammo. And if people thought World War III would be fought in Europe between NATO and the then emergent Warsaw Pact. So, you know, the M14 made a lot of sense. Now, there are a lot of people who predictably, you know, when you talk about, well, for my own personal use, I would prefer an FN. Well, that's neither here nor there. That's fine. There are a lot of people who would prefer to use one of the civilian versions of the M14, too. So that's not really part of the argument. The Belgians never designed the FNFAL as strictly a Belgian army, maybe sell it to a few friends kind of proposition. It was going to be sold worldwide, and that's why it had that adjustable gas system. And it adds a little complexity. There's a debate back and forth whether people really know how to adjust it or what to do with it. But it was designed so that it could take a variety of ammunition. And you could tune this system for the kind of ammunition you had. That was not a problem the U.S. Army had, because we had standardized ammunition and we were always going to have good quality ammunition to fire in it. So it was just not a big deal to us. The only other rifle that was on the scene would be the CENTMI, which became the G3. And frankly, as good a rifle as that is, it has what I consider to be a very heavy and mandatedly difficult trigger pull to prevent accidents. And it also does not have a bolt hold open device, which I've explained before is a real deal breaker for me. So there were two rifles out there. The AR-10 didn't survive testing. They tried to use a composite barrel, and that never works. That never works where you have two dissimilar metals, steel surrounded by something, and the heat dissipation becomes a problem, and the way the two different materials act under heat becomes can become problematic, because they're going to act different ways and do some wonky things. So, you know, it was really the M14, the FAL. The FAL was just too different and too dissimilar, and so there was really only one choice, and they made it. And people have been carping and kind of acting foolishly about it ever since. Now, for a country like, say, Rhodesia, who was operating in a very sandy, kind of dusty environment, and, you know, could get different kinds of lots of ammunition depending on where they got their supplies, kind of makes sense to have that adjustable gas system. So that would have been probably a really good choice for them. In the extreme sandy deserts, the Israelis had the FAL and didn't really care for it. And both the Israelis and the British kind of had to tweak it to operate in very sandy environments. But other than that, it's worked just fine. So there's no real loser if you have a G3, an FNFAL, or an M14. You can't go too far wrong. And really, the only problems you're going to have are personal preferences. So, I mean, I always kind of look at all their arguments kind of put into that context. And it's interesting to see how they become pro. Someone can become pro-FAL after using it in a match and then essentially throwing shade on it because it doesn't perform the way your AR does. So, anyway, that's the critique of their Q&A. I thought it was interesting, but by the same token, I thought that it really wasn't very informative. Okay, up next we have the initial impressions of the Brownell's Proto AR rifle. I just got my hands on one. Very, very nice rifle. Very well finished. Very well put together. Exceptionally high quality parts that have all been particle inspected, and they're chrome chambered and chrome lined barrel. All those good things. All the good things that you would see from a Colt-made rifle from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, it has. It's really, really well done. The furniture is plastic instead of the original fiberglass. That fiberglass didn't last very long. It looked great. It looked very cool. That kind of brown molted look to it and the sheen of the fiberglass. And that's not the Brownells furniture. They've got the contours exactly right, but it's done in a brown, I don't want to use the word plastic, but a brown polymer, I suppose, would be the best way to describe it. And it just doesn't have the sheen, it doesn't have the molted appearance, but it is brown. It does give you, it's, you know, for a tribute rifle, it's fine. It's actually fine. I thought I would really dislike it based on the furniture, but the furniture is fine. They are now including heat shields inside their handguards, so you know, it has a good feel to it. It doesn't feel flimsy or cheap or cheesy. It definitely has got it, and it's amazing how good the design is. It's just amazing. To be honest with you, one of the things I've never cared about the AR is the T charging handle in at the back of the rear sight, at the back of the what we call the carry handle. I've never really cared for that. You know, you kind of pull it back. It always seems awkward to me. I just don't really like it. And fortunately, you don't have to use it very much, but it's a bit awkward. That was not the original design. The original design had the trigger charging handle that was inside what we call the carry handle, but was actually really designed to protect that trigger charging handle. So it's really not a carry handle. That and mount the sights. I find that to be a lot easier to use. I like it a lot better, and I think it was a great design. The reason it became a dead end was, well, there are several reasons it became a dead end. The first was the Army wanted no part of it. They wanted no part of it. It is in a place where it can get some heat from the action, and so that, you know, those parts could get warm. Okay, that's a fine. There are a lot of other, believe me, there are a lot of our other Army weapons where pieces of them get warm. So that's not a big deal here. That's not a big deal. There is obviously a slot in the top of the receiver for this trigger handle to go back and forth, but the way it's designed, it really doesn't compromise the interior at all. When this thing's forward, when the bolt's forward, this thing is as tight as almost as any other AR. So that's not really a problem either. But the biggest thing I think is when you've got that trigger charging handle going back and forth, you know, when you're charging it and all that, you cannot have a sight mounted on the what we call the carrying handle again. Almost every AR after this one had a hole where you could put it. Started off with the you know, the Colt 3 and 4 power scopes, and then other things were put in there, M203 quadrant sights. They even had a brass deflector for the A1s that would fit in there, and it kind of had a ball detent and would go into that hole. And then a bunch of, you know, later on, a bunch of scope mounts actually would mount to that hole. So you actually had, you know, a really good scope mounting, optics mounting system there. It's high above the axis of the bore. There's no question about that. And it was eventually replaced by the flat top, which is much more optic mount friendly. But it was just never the original trigger charging handle was just never going to. Was never going to allow for optics to be mounted on that handle. So there you go. So that's why it became a dead end. However, if all you're going to shoot is irons, it is a very, very cool rifle. It's got all the things you would expect, the duckbill flash suppressor, And all those, you know, all those little touches that give it that retro look, a very retro looking front sight post, operates the same as the later ones, you know, where you can adjust it for elevation, but very good. And then it's got essentially what is an A1 sight on the at the rear. So it's a really excellent rifle, very lightweight, very well balanced, and you know, really, really a lot of fun. And it comes with a reproduction of the original 25 round magazine, which I find that to be a fascinating magazine. There's opinions out there that the reason that became was not used in later versions was reliability. I think probably another reason was it monopodded the rifle in a way that nobody had really seen before. Plus, the follow-on 20-round magazines were so compact, reliable, and you know, kind of easy to handle that I think they saw the 25-rounder didn't really help very much. Now, of course, later on, with combat experience in Southeast Asia, the 30-rounder was introduced in the late 1960s. And this was a necessary improvement when you're going against the AK-47, which had a 30-round capacity also. It was very helpful to have those additional rounds. And that became the standard magazine up through until today. I mean, you essentially, in states that allow the sale of it, you buy an AR and you get 30-round magazines with it. And you go to any kind of shop or store that sells gun-related stuff, AR-related stuff, and you see, you know, a lot of aftermarket 30-round magazines. The 20s have kind of made a little bit of a comeback simply because they are compact, easy to shoot, and they do have, you know, reasonable capacity. But it's really a 30-rounder for use of the AR today. Now, the question always lingers, will Brownell sell enough of these rifles to keep them in production? As much as I like it, and as much cool factor as it has, and as much as neat as I think it is, I don't really think so. I think what's going to happen is the people who buy these are going to want them because it fills in a niche in a collection, or it's just fun to have and shoot, but it's not going to be someone's first AR. And the AR market has incredible competition in it now. You can basically get you know, $450 up. So, you know, and that comes to where the price point of these retro rifles that Brownells has, and there are a few other companies that make these things also. What price point is a good price point? This rifle, the AR Proto, has got a $14.99 MSRP. It's been on sale several times for $12.99. It's been recently on sale for $9.99. So, you know, maybe around the $1,000 threshold, that's still high for an AR. You can buy two of something else. They won't be fancy ARs, but you could buy two other ARs for essentially that money. So it's going to be interesting to see how well how long they stay in the marketplace, how long they're commercially viable. Right now, people want them because you haven't been able to get a trigger charging handle AR except on a custom basis for 65 years. So, you know, this will be it'll be interesting to see how long they last. I personally hope they last a long time, and I think people would be well served to see the value in the retro AR and really how close to the market is today. YouTubers talk about, well, it's been continually upgraded and all this continuous R&D. And I would say as far as add-ons, that's true. But the basic mechanism is the basic mechanism. You can take a basic upper and a basic lower, and they're fundamentally the same as they were 60 years ago. With the flat top being an exception, but really not that much different, especially the lowers. Yeah, there's contours, and there's a fence around the magazine release button. Okay, that's all well and good, but it's really not that big of a change. Not that big of a change at all. And some would even say that, and I'm one of them, I don't know that all those fences are all, they look cool and they make the gun look cool, but I don't know that they do a whole lot. I don't know that they're absolutely necessary. A lot of things seem to be a good idea at the time and turn out to be, well, maybe this isn't as helpful as we think. So I want to see it. I think the $1,000 price point is probably right for these rifles, and we'll see where it goes from there. But you know, I'm glad Brownells has brought them out, because a lot of people can't afford the $3,000 and $4,000 custom jobs, but they can afford this. So again, an excellent piece of kit and well worthy of consideration. Okay, here we are at my favorite part of the show, and that is questions and answers. So let's go really quick and see the first one. And this came from someone where I work. Have you seen the 6.5 Creedmoor ARs and the 6.5 Creedmoor M1A? And what advantages do they offer? Well, I've seen them. They offer no advantages, so who cares? Why you would want a gas gun for a cartridge like that, I don't know. I suppose everybody's chasing accuracy and all the rest. It's 6.5 Creedmoor is a great cartridge. I have a Savage rifle in it. To me, its optimal use is in a good quality bolt action with an excellent optic. Then you can take advantage of that cartridge's inherent accuracy. As a hunting round, I don't know that I have any opinion on it. It'll certainly kill game. It'll certainly do that. You can buy hunting rounds for it. They're a little more expensive than some of the other rounds, but it's fine, and they make some reasonably priced hunting rifles for it. I think Savage Axis, Ruger American. I think there's a couple of those. I think HOA makes a couple of them too that are, you know, suitable for that. So, you know, it's a good deal for that. You want to use it for hunting, fine. Why you would buy a predominantly military style gas gun in it, really kind of, I don't know. If you're building some sort of super sniper rifle, I would use a different platform, and I would use the one that optimizes the accuracy. So build something that would look like more like a PRS rifle, bolt action, than those either of the gas guns, the M1A or the kind of the AR-10 style. All you're really going to get in those two rifles is something that shoots maybe a little better, maybe not, maybe the same, as your 7.62 NATO, and is going to be more expensive, going to be more difficult to find. You know, you can get 7.62 NATO, you know, excluding the Russian steel case junk, excluding that. You can get that $13-$14 a box, and probably better. You can even still get surplus 7.62x51, and those are going to shoot out very, very well. And you don't have the hassles of, you know, mounting optics on even a flat top AR can be a little challenging, and M1A is certainly more challenging. I know, because I've done it, and you know, I think you're just better off going with a bolt action. It's like 300 blackout. You're going to shoot it in a suppressed arm, great. That's what it's really made for. You're going to shoot it for any other use, and, you know, I just don't think it has the performance. So my initial thing is, yeah, I've seen them, but who cares? The next question is, Colt versus Smith & Wesson in revolvers. And I'm like, I have to think about that one a little bit. First of all, Colt doesn't really make revolvers anymore. I think they've just reintroduced the King Cobra, but they really don't make much anymore. And they've been out since about 2000. They've been out of the revolver business. But back in, you know, this question is probably coming from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even the 80s. There was a big competition between the two. Smith & Wesson had excellent, out of the box, Smith & Wesson had excellent lock work. Really good triggers, really good sights. Good guns, really good guns. Colt had a very smooth lock work, a little more delicate, wasn't quite as robust, but they had an excellent trigger pull. And then they had the Python, which was essentially hand fitted, so it was really up there. You know, I'm talking all out of the box, because I know you could take a Smith & Wesson to a gunsmith and get them to do all kinds of things to it, but you know, out of the box. So it was kind of this back and forth as to which one was which. Smith & Wesson eventually won, and really I think they won for two reasons. First was Colt was getting out of the commercial firearms business, or retreating from it, because they had a lot of lucrative government contracts for M16A2s and M4s and all of that. The next reason was, I think Smith & Wesson offered a quality that was very dependable. When you bought a Smith & Wesson revolver, and even today, you know you're getting a very accurate revolver. You know you're getting a good product. And they built a solid market reputation. And so they also offered more models. And it wasn't until kind of late in the game that Colt actually got on board with 45 Colt and 44 Magnum. And they did that in their Anaconda, which was a good but not great revolver. And that was late in the game. That was kind of late in the game. The revolver era was ending when they brought that out. So, you know, Smith & Wesson brought out the products people wanted when they wanted them. And they've kind of continued to do so. They've kept the revolver alive. So I think that's the genesis of that. Is there a preference with myself? No. I think they're both great. I do prefer Smith & Wesson. I just do. But that could be just because I fired them more. And so I would say that I really don't have a logic-based preference. Mine is probably just based on what I'm most used to. So that's the difference between Colt and Smith & Wesson with revolvers. Okay, here's a related question. Is the Chief Model 36, I think that's the Smith & Wesson Model 36 Chief Special, is that still a viable CCW gun? And what is your opinion of it? It's a great little revolver. Five shots. I guess the lore behind it was designed for detectives and police chiefs who needed to be armed, but not in an ostentatious way with a duty, with a like a Sam Brown belt and a holster. If they were in a business suit type situation and needed to be armed, it was a very, very concealable gun. Took the same kind of 38s that their department probably used, and I assume, you know, having a gun like that kind of distinguished you as it was kind of a badge of honor. It distinguished you as a member of the higher ranking or very important people in a police department. But it's a great little gun. They've made it in blue, and then I think the Model 60 in stainless. And, you know, they're still around. You can buy them new and used. And, you know, its only limitation is five shots. And I'm pretty sure no plus P. I would not do that. But it's a good little gun, but you got to accept those two limitations. I would say that, you know, the smaller 9mm are probably going to make it pretty much obsolete, and I don't think you'll see anybody carrying it. And I think the kind of people who would carry it now are probably traditionalists, and I think that's just going to shrink. If you really need an efficient gun, the newer automatics, and even the Smith & Wesson Shield is one of them, are really probably a little better suited. Plus, they're at a lower price point. You know, that's the other thing. What do these things cost? And the answer is, a good revolver costs more than a comparable semi-automatic pistol. It just does. So, price point and capacity will probably determine how long those stick around. Okay, here's another question. Walther P38 versus M1911 A1. Okay, which was the best pistol in World War II? Well, I think you can say that the Walther was certainly very innovative, being double action. It was the first, I believe, probably the first widespread issued double action service auto. So for that alone, it deserves a big place. Which one would I rather be armed with is probably pretty easy. I'm very familiar with the M1911A1. I carried it as a duty gun, so that's the one I would use hands down. I like the thumb magazine release. I like the 45 caliber. I like the way it loads. I like the way it feels. I like the 1911A1 sights. They're easier for me to see than the original 1911 sights. The P-38 has got some great attributes to it. It's got very good sights on it, the World War II version and the later post-war versions that had the aluminum frame. It's got very good sights. To me, the balance isn't quite as good. It's in 9mm, which is not a real problem, but if you're shooting FMJ, I think I'd rather have the 45. Capacity is about the same. I don't really care for the Heel release magazine. That's just the way it goes. I understand the reason for it, but I don't really care for it. So I would say that that's what I would choose, the 1911. The P-38 has had its detractors over the years, and that's predominantly because it was not made in the United States. Gun writers could take a big swipe at it and use it as kind of a bad example. Jeff Cooper, you know, is like, well, it's an ingenious solution to a non-existent problem. And I've seen them fire when you use the hammer drop, which I've never seen, but I'm not doubting that that could not happen. I'm just saying I've never seen it. So it was easy to use as a bad example, because you wouldn't make anybody angry who was trying to advertise in your magazine. You know, gun writers had to be real careful. So that's it definitely was the kind of weapon that you could definitely be the brunt of your criticism. I do have to say, though, it has a great presence in movies and in kind of fiction. I mean, it has a very businesslike but very sinister at the same time appearance. And it's been used in more movies than you can count, both World War II and others. And, you know, it does have a tremendous visual impact. So the P-38 is definitely a great gun, and it's been the basis for really a lot of guns, including the Beretta 92 series and a few others. You know, there's a lot of its design elements are in modern guns that are still being made today. Okay, next question. Have you seen one of the CMP released and sold M1911A1s from the U.S. government? And if so, what did you think of it? Well, I haven't seen one. As I mentioned earlier, I carried an M1911A1 as a duty weapon, so I really wanted to purchase one of the CMP pistols. So I put in for it and all that. My number came out in the 11,000 somewhere, so I'm pretty much up in the cheap seats as far as the pistols go, because they only had 8,000 of them. I think they said 40 or 50 of them they couldn't sell. I'm assuming that's cracked frames. And just unserviceability. So that leaves something under 7,000 pistols, something under 8,000 pistols. And tell you what really ticks me off, though, and there's no way this is not on the CMP. This is on just greed, avarice, and the general, even how gun people can be really crappy human beings. There are people who actually, they put in, they're fortunate, they get a low number, they buy one, and then they're flipping the things. They're selling them because they know the gun they paid $900 or $1,000 for, you know, in a market that's interested in 1911A1s, they can sell it. Even though they're Mixmasters and have been rebuilt, they can make some money on it, a few hundred dollars anyway, $300 or $400 probably. And so it really makes me mad that I don't have one that I wanted as a memento from my service, thinking, hey, it's really cool. I served at the same time this pistol did. Now I have the, you know, the privilege of owning it. Other people don't have, you know, they just bought them. And some people signed up all their friends and relatives and everybody else. And a gentleman who I know that works in a large gun retail environment told me that a customer came in wanting to sell eight of these. So he must have signed up all the adults in his family. They all must have drawn numbers under 7,000. And he had $7,000 or $8,000 to spend on these things where he bought them. And maybe even had more, I don't know. But he's obviously going to keep the one he wants and then sell the rest at premiums and make money off the deal, this was never designed to make money. There's no way the CMP can police this. And guys have been doing this with M1s for a long time. Part of the reason you go into gun shops and you see, hey, a really nice M1, not import marked, is people flipping them. They buy three or four of them over a space of a year or two, keep the one they want, sell the other ones at a premium, and it comes out zero cost to them. They get an M1 for no cost, and because the return on the investment for the other ones covers the cost of the rifle they kept. So, you know, this has been going on, and I really dislike that. Now, you know, at some point, the guns I've gotten from the CMP will come up for sale, but I'll be gone. It'll be my heirs selling them. That's all legit. Or, you know, hey, you know, heaven forbid, you get Parkinson's disease 10 years or 20 years after you bought it. You can't shoot it anymore. You need the money. You sell it. Okay, I get that too. But the profiteering and the hoarding and just keeping them from others, it's BS. Like I said, there's nothing that can be done other than the CMP could refuse to sell to them. But these things are popping up on GunBroker. They're walking into gun stores. And it's really a shame. And I mean, that might hurt the program more than the Democrats do. It may be the point where, if one of these gets used in a crime or gets used in some kind of high-profile shooting case, it's going to come to a screeching frickin' halt. I guarantee it. So, you know, the best place for these things to go is into the vaults of collectors, people who appreciate them for their history, people who want a memento of their service. And that's really the best thing. The profiteering is very, very bad, and it really needs to go. Okay, here's the last question we'll have for today, and here it is. Do you compete in shooting matches? And if so, what is your favorite matches or your favorite competition? Well, I've competed in a variety of different things. As I said in an earlier podcast, probably the most fun I've had in a match was at a thing called Zoot Shooting, where you dress up like characters out of the 1920s and 30s and, you know, semi-automatic Thompsons and all that. And it's a lot of fun. That was great. Routinely, I do vintage military rifle shooting. I really enjoy that. I love the history. And I just like the fact that the rifles are fairly modern, but, you know, bolt action and early semi-automatic. I really like that era of rifles. Craftsmanship was beautiful. And even in mass production, the engineering was really, really phenomenal. So I shoot those quite a bit. I don't really do as much pistol as I would like. I'd like to get into some pistol, but, you know, that's a future goal here for the next year or so. I've shot both cartridge and black powder pistol, revolver, not in cast, but in other things. I enjoy that quite a bit. I really enjoy cap and ball pistols. I really do. They're inexpensive, they're fun, they're a really great way to shoot. And, you know, it doesn't take, a lot of people are leery of black powder substitutes. It's really not that difficult, and it's a really good way to learn about how weapons are and how they shoot. So I'm pretty much a fan of those. I do like black powder cartridge rifles, but only the vintage ones, not really the new ones. That's about it for competition. I really don't do. I used to do, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. NRA bullseye shooting, small bore bullseye with both rifle and pistol. I like it. You know, it's fun. You truss up in the shooting code and put the sling on and shoot the 14 pound 22. You know, it's a lot of fun. It really is. The pistol was great too because it was just discipline, you know, and shooting the rapid fire, shooting the slow fire. I really enjoyed that. And 22 is it's a lot of fun to shoot, and it really has become something that you could really work on your marksmanship with it. It's a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed that, and it was inexpensive. I enjoyed that too. I was hoping NRL 22 would kind of rekindle or recapture some of that, but it really has not. So I'm a bit disappointed in that. So that's what I enjoy shooting the most. The other thing I enjoy shooting is just shooting with friends. I enjoy that. I certainly like it when a new shooter or non-shooter comes out, just wants to check it out, or a novice shooter, you know, somebody who's just getting into it. I enjoy that part of the introducing people to the sport and, you know, introducing them to something that they can do essentially the rest of their active lives. You know, that's a great thing. So anyway, that's what I do. And this brings us to the end of another episode of Old School Guns. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, please hit the follower button and you'll get notified whenever a new episode is put up on Podbean. If you have any comments or questions, you can feel free to put them in the comments section, and I will address them in the next podcast. I do read those things. Right now, though, this is Old School Guns, out.